Welcome, everyone. Looks like it's about time to get things underway again. Thanks for coming out. For this, the third of three classes when we've been looking at the Book of Revelation in some different ways. Before we get started on our material for today, I wanted to put a little plug in case you're not tired of Revelation yet. I'm actually, after the lectureship's over, I'm staying around here for two more weeks and teaching an intensive two-week summer course for Pepperdine on Revelation and apocalyptic literature. So if you're not sick of it yet, you're welcome to join us. You know, if you got 2 weeks to kill and nothing to do, feel free to audit the class or come and sit in with us. We'd love to have you. So just wanted to extend that invitation to you. Kind of review very quickly what we've done the last couple of days. We've been exploring some of the ways in which I think Revelation is a highly relevant book, an important book for Christian faith today, particularly as it revolves around and connects to themes of evil and suffering. In the first class, we talked a lot about the sovereignty of God, and this vision in chapter 4 of God sitting on his throne, and how John is trying in Revelation to address what I call the faith crisis. And this is typically what apocalyptic literature tries to do, is that when you have people who are in a situation where, again, what their faith tells them is true about God comes into conflict with their experience of the world, you know, it creates a faith crisis. Right? How do I explain my experience, which seems very real to me, with what my faith tells me is true about God? So I believe God is just, but I'm experiencing injustice. Right? How do I reconcile those two? In the second lecture, we looked at, in particular, the question of how to live out the Christian faith, daily in a world that is antagonistic to that faith. We talked about this contrast between these two kingdoms that are at war in Revelation, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the world. And in particular, we focused on what I call the pattern of the Christ. We argued that Jesus is central to understanding the book of Revelation. This is a book that's about Jesus from beginning to end. In fact, we noticed how when, you know, John calls Revelation a work of prophecy, but then he defines himself what he means by that in Revelation 19:10, when he says, "The witness of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." You know, that for John is what prophecy is all about. It's all about Jesus. The witness of Jesus, the witness to Jesus. And we looked at how Jesus establishes a pattern in Revelation for a faithful witness. And that is, first, that he is a faithful witness against the kingdom of the world. Second part is, because of his faithful witness, he suffers, even to the point of death. But the third part is that that death and that suffering is not the end, and God brings vindication. Right? Through the resurrection and the exaltation of Christ, he is rewarded for his faithful witness. And by looking in particular at chapter 11 last time, we argued that John is saying that is our responsibility in the world today. That we are being called upon to take up that pattern of the Christ in our own lives. That we are called to be faithful witnesses against the kingdom of the world, knowing that when you do that, the kingdom of the world fights back. And it may very well lead to suffering and hardship. But that if we are truly faithful witnesses, then we also will receive vindication. And so yesterday we talked about the first two parts of that pattern, faithful witness and suffering. Today we're going to connect that to the third part of the pattern, which is vindication. First, though, you know, when they enlist you for these types of lectures, they ask you for your titles months in advance, before you've thought at all about what you want to say. And so when they ask, you know, I kind of had a pretty good idea then what I wanted to do in the first two lectures. But I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do this time, so I just quickly jotted down a title and sent it in. And the title I sent in was Revelation, War, and the Language of Hope. As it turns out, I got two of the three right. As I started to prepare this, I began to realize that the concept of war didn't really fit in with what I wanted to say today. And in fact, it fit in very well with what I said yesterday. So as you recall, we talked a lot about war, the war metaphor yesterday. So today I'm shifting that a little bit. The actual title we're working with is Revelation, Suffering, and the Language of Hope. So if you came here looking for war this morning, I apologize. But we'll try to send you on your way with some hope.
Not too suffering.
Yeah, hopefully not suffering. Before we do that, though, I want to address a couple of background issues that I think are important here. One is I want to talk about symbolism. Now, you don't have to read Revelation very long before you realize this is a highly symbolic book. John communicates through symbols, and that's a standard trope for apocalyptic literature. All apocalypses communicate through symbolic language. But it's also the nature of Revelation that causes us so many problems. Right? This is why you have so many misinterpretations of this book, because we don't know what to do with the symbolism. And symbols are inherently fluid. They can often be interpreted in a number of different ways. And maybe you've heard this before, but a very, very common way of thinking about Revelation is that Revelation is a code. One explanation is to say the reason John wrote in symbols was to try to hide his message. He was concerned that if the Romans found out, if he was saying the Romans were the bad guys, they'd get persecuted even worse. And so he had to use symbolisms to hide the message from prying eyes so that only the faithful few would understand it. I have some serious problems with that view. I don't think that's why Revelation is written in symbols. One reason is because if that's what John is trying to do, he did a pretty poor job of it. Because the symbols that he used are symbols that would have communicated very clearly in that culture. And the way John describes Rome in this book would have been obvious to any ancient person that he was talking about Rome. The Romans would not have missed this if they had bothered to read this book. John refers to the great prostitute in chapter 17 as sitting on seven hills. Right? Everybody knew that Rome was the city that sat on seven hills. I mean, that's very thinly veiled symbolism there. And the fact is, we have a problem with the symbolism because it's so foreign to us. But we have to realize that John's audience understood this symbolism much better than we do. I'm one of these people who resisted cell phones for as long as humanly possible. I didn't want a cell phone, not because I'm opposed to technology. I love technology, but I did not want to be available to people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, finally, once I started having kids and I realized, it might not be a bad idea to be able to get a hold of my wife in different situations. So I finally broke down and got a cell phone. But then I went as bare bones as possible. I mean, no texting, like probably 5 minutes a month is what I paid for. I don't know. But it was as simple as you could possibly get. And survived on that for quite a while. Actually, up until last week. when I was getting ready to leave and come here and my kids were going to be, my kids are older now, so they're all over the place. So I finally broke down and I got a brand new cell phone that actually has unlimited texting and things for it. I had never texted before. And I get to this campus, and of course I've got MetroPCS, and it won't work here. I can't make any phone calls or get them. So I had to break down and finally start using texting. And so my daughter sent me some text yesterday for the first time, and I'm trying to figure all this out. And she sent me this text. It said there was an I, and then a less than symbol, and a 3, followed by the word you. And I'm thinking, why is she trying to get me to do math here? And I had to look at that for a while until I finally figured out she was using these symbols to try and say, I love you. It was completely foreign to me. I didn't understand anything that she had put down there until I was clued into the symbols and what they meant and how she was using them. And then it made perfect sense. And that's the way it is for John's audience. We're looking at that and we don't understand these symbols. But they understood these symbols because they were drawn from their culture. Randy Harris last night talked about Revelation chapter 12 and the war in heaven. And there's this war that breaks out, the dragon and his angels, Michael and his angels. Well, to John's audience, that was a familiar story. In Greek culture, particularly for John, those Christians who converted to John's churches from the Greek culture, and anybody who lived in that area knew this story. There's a very famous story in Greek mythology of a war in heaven between the gods on the one hand and the giants on the other. And these giants were these large figures who were human from the waist up and serpents from the waist down. And so you have, in fact, in the city of Pergamum, one of the seven letters, they had this giant altar that was 18 feet high. And if you've ever seen pictures of it, around the sides of the altars, there's a whole bunch of sculpture. Well, what's depicted on the side of that altar is this war in heaven between the gods and the giants. And so when they hear this language of a war in heaven, that communicates to them. They understand what that kind of a story means. If you open your newspapers to the cartoon section or the editorial section, you'll see political cartoons a lot. And if you look there, you see a cartoon, and there's an elephant and a donkey talking to each other. What's that cartoon about? Yeah, how do you know that? Yeah. I mean, how would you know that an elephant is a Republican and a donkey is a Democrat? Well, because you understand those symbols. You know, you understand that in our culture, we use these animals to represent these political parties. Well, that's, you know, that's a lot of what's going on in apocalyptic literature. They tend to use animals as well to represent things. And so when they turn to Revelation 12 and they meet a red dragon, they know what that means, because they have red dragons in their stories, in their culture. When they meet this beast who, you know, has a human head and a body of a lion and the wings of an eagle, they know what that meant because they saw them all around them. You know, I could show you a bunch of pictures. You know, they had these composite creatures, you know, on their coins, on their sculpture, on their statuary. They understood what these symbols meant. So it's not that John is trying to hide the message. In fact, symbolism really doesn't conceal as much as it reveals. You know, John calls his book a revelation because he's not trying to hide something. He's trying to expose something, trying to reveal something. So when John calls Jesus a slaughtered lamb, again, he's not trying to hide the identity of Jesus. He's trying to reveal something important about who Jesus is. Right? He's trying to tell us through that symbol something significant about Jesus. And so the reason I have a problem with seeing Revelation as a code is it means to understand the book, then you have to break the code. In fact, there was a book published several years ago called Breaking the Code about Revelation. And to break the code means you got to get rid of the symbols to find out what's behind them. And if you do that, you destroy everything John's trying to do, because the symbols are the message. Right? He's communicating through symbols because the symbols are the best way of saying what he wants to say. So I want to highlight, for instance, three reasons why I think John writes in symbols and why apocalyptic literature is so fond of symbols. One is that symbols are a very powerful form of communication. On the one hand, symbols are very visual language. Right? And so, you know, Revelation connects with us visually in a way other books in the New Testament don't. You know, you read these chapters and you kind of picture the scene in your head. It's like John's creating a movie for us. And, you know, that visual imagery can connect in a much more powerful way. Not only that, but symbols tend to be more emotional forms of communication. You know, if you put up the American flag, you know, as a symbol, one person sees that and is filled with anger and hatred. Another person sees that and is filled with great pride. You know, these symbols sort of connect to our emotions in a way and are able to make us feel things in a way that normal language oftentimes struggles to do. And so, for instance, you know, if John wants to talk about what Jesus accomplished on the cross, you know, he could have just given us this lengthy disputation, sort of start talking about sacrifice and forgiveness of sins and just kind of describing what Jesus did for us. But that's not nearly as powerful as just simply holding up this image of a slaughtered lamb. There's something about that symbol that just connects with us on a more visceral level and is much more powerful. Second, symbols allow us to express the inexpressible. I have no idea if I just spelled that right. Close enough. And I think Randy talked about this some last night as well. But my colleague at Rochester College, Saeed Khan, yesterday used this analogy. I'm going to steal it from him because it really captures this point very well. In the movie Contact, if you've seen that movie, Jodie Foster is a scientist who, you know, believes that she's made contact with an alien civilization, and they end up creating this sort of wormhole that she's able to travel through to go visit this alien civilization. And she has this amazing transcendent experience when she gets there, and she comes back and she goes before this sort of Senate committee, and they're very disbelieving of her. They're not sure that she really made this trip, and they ask her what it was like, what she experienced, and she says, "I can't explain it." She says, "It would have been better if you sent a poet rather than a scientist, because as a scientist she didn't have the language to describe it, but a poet could." All right? Because poets know how to speak in symbols. Right? They talk in figurative language. And that kind of language is able to express things that you can't express in normal language. For instance, if you think about Revelation 21 and 22, this sort of vision that John gives us of heaven, you know, the problem with trying to communicate what John's trying to communicate is he's trying to reveal to us spiritual truth. The problem with that is we're physical beings. Right? None of us have ever experienced the spiritual realm. We've never been to heaven. We have never encountered any of this. And so John's trying to explain things to us that can't be explained. I don't know if this is the best analogy. I've been trying to find a different one, but it works for now. But one analogy I use with my students is, imagine if you were given the job, you were told, okay, there's this infant over there still in the womb, almost ready to be born. And your job is to communicate to that infant what this world's going to be like when they get here. All right, how would you do that? Well, it's almost an impossible task because they have no frame of reference. Right? You know, in that womb, in their environment, I mean, how in the world are you going to explain to them what a tree is? They have no way of conceiving of that. You know, the best you could maybe do is try to think of things from their environment that are somewhat similar and try to extrapolate from that. You know, that's what John does. You know, when he describes this city in Revelation 21 as having streets of gold, he's not necessarily saying that there are literally streets of gold in heaven. He's saying, you know, I'm trying to explain something to you that's unexplainable, and here's the best I can do. You know, so he chooses, you know, the most valuable thing you can think of in this world and says, well, it's kind of like that, but even that doesn't capture the truth of it. But symbols are this way of trying to get at and express something that you can't express otherwise. Third reason for using symbolism is it provides a new perspective. Now, C.S. Lewis, in this famous book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know, he tells a story through symbols. And basically, he tells, in some ways, the story of Jesus using symbolism. So rather than having, you know, a person in the cross, you have a lion in the table. And you might wonder, well, why would he do that? Well, in one of his essays, when he was talking about, you know, these kinds of stories and why he wrote this, he explained that one of the reasons he did that was he felt that Christians had domesticated the story of Jesus. In other words, that this is a story, every Sunday we go to church and we retell this story over and over again, we hear it over and over again, and it's lost its power. You know, we're so familiar with it that it doesn't move us anymore. And so what he wanted to do by using symbols was to tell the same story in an unfamiliar way. And so it forces you to encounter the story anew, encounter it fresh, and hopefully through that, restore the power of the story. And I would suggest that's exactly what John's doing as well. Right? That one of the reasons he uses symbols is to get us to see things from a new perspective, in a new way that maybe we hadn't thought of before. And he does a similar thing to what C.S. Lewis does. He keeps retelling the story of Jesus just in a different way. We saw this yesterday in chapter 11, where he tells us the story of the two witnesses. So you've got these two witnesses who witness faithfully in the face of opposition. They're killed in the city where Jesus was crucified. 3.5 days later, they're resurrected, and then they ascend to heaven. Right? That's the story of Jesus. But he just took the story of Jesus, but retold it using these two witnesses. He does it in chapter 12, where he tells the story of a pregnant woman who's going to give birth to a child who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. But he gives birth to this child. This child experiences great opposition from the dragon, but the child grows up and defeats the dragon by his blood. And then as a result of that, the dragon is mad and goes after the woman's offspring and tries to destroy them. And the women's offspring are described as all of those who hold to the testimony of Jesus. In other words, he's just retold the Christian story. Right? You've got the birth of the Messiah, you have the cross, and then you have the church and its experience of opposition in the world. And that's what he's doing in chapter 12. He's just retelling the story that we know so well in a way that we don't know and getting us to see it in some new ways and think about it in some new ways. So what I want us to appreciate again, you know, I want us to try and learn to appreciate the symbolism and how the symbols are the message, and learn to get the most out of that. Second thing I want to do, by way of introduction, is I want to make a few comments about suffering before we try to connect some of this. I remember when I was about 6 years old, we lived in Chicago at the time, And I was down in the basement of our house, and there was a little short step that came down to the basement. And my grandmother, who was living with us, was coming down the stairs, and she started to walk down the stairs, and she lost her balance, and her legs sort of gave out, and she kind of fell down the stairs a little ways. And I remember as she did, she sort of grabbed onto the railing and was trying to pull herself up. And she said out loud, she said, "God, what did I do to deserve this?" And, you know, I think about that, and, you know, looking back, at the time, of course, I didn't know what to say, but looking back, my answer would be she did nothing. You know, she didn't do anything to deserve that. Sometimes suffering just is. You know, it's not deserved, it's not fair, and it just doesn't make sense. You know, a couple years ago, at the Rochester Church of Christ, where I attend, we went through a period of, it was just over a few short months, where a lot of tragedy seemed to hit. We had one young mother who died of cancer, and then shortly after that, our worship minister died in a hunting accident. Then a 7-year-old boy was killed in a tragic accident. And then two twin brothers in their early 20s were in a car accident, and one of them was killed, and the other suffered debilitating injuries. And this was all within a few short months of each other. And the church really struggled with this. You know, how do we explain this? How do we make sense of this? And the fact is, I'm not sure we can. You know, what makes suffering so hard is its incomprehensibility. You know, sometimes it just doesn't fit with our conception of how things are supposed to be. It just doesn't seem to serve any larger purpose. And I want to highlight two things with respect to this that I think help put it in context. These are two faulty assumptions that sometimes people make with respect to suffering. And the first is the assumption that suffering must make sense. You know, we so want to make sense of it, and we try so hard to make sense of it, but sometimes we simply can't. Suffering is just a part of the human experience, and there are so many causes and variables involved that there is no one explanation fits all kind of scenario. You know, if a man murders a teenager, we might explain that away as a deliberate act of evil. But that same logic doesn't work when a mother of two has her tire blow out and she's killed in an accident. Or if an overweight, you know, 50-year-old man dies of a heart attack, we can write that off as a, you know, lifetime of accumulation of bad choices. But that reasoning doesn't make any sense when an infant is born with a terminal disease. You know, there is no simple explanation that accounts for all suffering. And we may say, well, what about Revelation 4? You know, it tells us that God's on this throne, that God is sovereign. That means that God is sovereign over suffering as well. So suffering must have a purpose in his plan. And I would say yes. I believe suffering does have a purpose in God's plan. And I think part of the message of Revelation 4 is that even suffering comes under God's sovereign control. Where the assumption, or the faulty assumption lies, I would say, is not in the faith claim that suffering plays a role in God's plan and makes sense within God's wisdom. The faulty assumption is that somehow if we just look at the world hard enough and try hard enough, we can make sense of it. That we can make sense of suffering on the basis of our wisdom. I think sometimes we just need to come clean that God's ways are not our ways, that his thoughts are not our thoughts. And because of that, sometimes suffering just doesn't make any sense at all from our perspective. In fact, there's this great scene I like in another ancient apocalyptic writing called 4th Ezra. And there's a scene where Ezra is talking to an angel named Uriel, and Ezra's having a very difficult time understanding what's going on. He's bothered by the fact that the Jewish people are suffering, that God doesn't seem to be doing anything about it. He's asking the angel about this. He's not getting the answers he wants. He's getting very frustrated by it. And the angel responds to him and says, "Those who dwell upon earth can understand only what is on earth." In other words, we have this limited perspective. And we have to understand that God's perspective is much bigger. And so things that might make sense within God's wisdom just may not make sense based on our own. The second faulty assumption I would highlight is the assumption that the plan of God must be concerned first and foremost with the alleviation of my suffering. You know, we tend to assume that somehow suffering is inconsistent with the life of faith because we don't like to suffer. So we assume that any divine plan must include the elimination of my suffering. And yet Revelation offers a different perspective. We've mentioned this before, but in Revelation, God doesn't do away with suffering. Rather, he joins us in it, in the form of the slaughtered lamb. You know, God seems to have a different valuation of suffering in Revelation than we do. In fact, you know, as we said yesterday in Revelation, we are called to follow the pattern of the Christ, of being a faithful witness. And if we do that, John says it's going to lead to more suffering, not less. Now, John did not write Revelation to try to remove their suffering. If anything, he's calling upon them to behave in ways that will probably increase their suffering. What he's doing is writing to give them the strength to endure that, and to live in that suffering. And so it's kind of hard for us to hear sometimes, but Revelation seems to suggest that God's plan is not simply for our individual happiness, but that God's plan is for all creation. You know, we tend to put ourselves often at the center of God's plan, and everything revolves around us. Revelation is trying to break us of that perspective and to see ourselves in light of the bigger picture of what God is doing, not just in our lives, but in all creation from beginning to end. And I want to explore that idea here. First, by talking about a couple of other concepts here. One is eschatology. And eschatology is a fancy term that just refers to end-time language. You know, John talks a lot about, you know, language that seems to talk about the end of time and what God's going to do in the future. And one of the reasons for that is to challenge our assumptions that God is not faithful unless he provides blessings and comfort in this life. You know, eschatology, again, is about getting us to see what God is doing on the bigger stage. It challenges this assumption that somehow God is not being just or fair unless he resolves my problems in my lifetime. Now, the fancy term that's used for this is determinism. All apocalyptic writings are deterministic, which means they argue that God has a plan, he has determined that plan, and he's going to fulfill it faithfully. But one of the reasons for this kind of language, that, you know, God has a plan that he's faithfully working out, is to get us to view our, you know, 70 plus years or whatever in light of that bigger plan that God has in place. You know, God is working something out on the grand stage of all human history, and we are just one small part of that. And so John is trying to get us to expand our viewpoint here. And so he would suggest that if we want to think seriously about evil and suffering and how God engages evil and suffering, we can't do it strictly in terms of what God has done in the past and what God is doing right now. We must also think in terms of what God will do. In Revelation, he's the God who was, is, and is to come. He's past, present, and future. And so if we evaluate our suffering simply in terms of our past, you know, how we've suffered in the past, or our present, how we're suffering right now, then that's incomplete, because the story isn't over yet. Second term, apocalypse. Right, you hear the word apocalypse, and what comes to mind? Usually destruction, end of the world, devastation. You know, we have all these movies about the apocalypse and how everything's going to be destroyed and end. That's an idea, though, that has developed over centuries and is not really representative of what ancient apocalyptic was. In part, there's a term I have that's used a lot. You've probably heard post-apocalyptic, you know, which refers to what comes after the apocalypse. So you have the apocalypse and then what comes after. And usually what comes after is people trying to recover from the devastation. So, you know, The Walking Dead is a post-apocalyptic show. You've had, you know, this massive devastation, and then you got people trying to recover from it and survive it. I understand what that term means and how it functions in modern culture. That term cannot really apply to ancient views of apocalyptic at all, because in ancient apocalyptic, there is no post. In other words, the idea that somehow apocalypse is about destruction, and then we can talk about what comes after, I think is wrong, because apocalyptic is very much about what comes after. That's a part of what an apocalypse is. Apocalypse is very... Or in other words, I would suggest that apocalyptic is not so much about destruction as it is about creation. It's not about an ending, but about a beginning. And to highlight that, I want us to explore the theme of resurrection in Revelation. We don't usually think about that theme very much. But if John is really working out of this pattern of the Christ, faithful witness, suffering and death, leading to vindication, resurrection is a very prominent theme in how John thinks as he structures this book. You know, that pattern of the Christ, again, we see in a lot of places in Revelation. Chapter 1, verse 5, for instance. Jesus is referred to as the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead. I know you've got all three parts of that pattern there. He's the faithful witness. Because of that, he was dead. But now he's the firstborn from the dead. He's been resurrected. But Revelation chapter 1:18. I am the living one. I was dead, and see, I am alive forever and ever, and I have the keys of death and Hades. And again, there's that vindication where he witnessed and he was dead, but now he is the living one. And both of those statements come in chapter 1, where John presents this idea of the resurrection to us right off the bat. He wants us thinking in terms of resurrection, in terms of Christ as the living one. And part of that is because if we're called to follow the pattern of the Christ, to be faithful witnesses in the world, even if that leads to death, John wants us to know that that's not the end of the story. Right? There is resurrection. There is vindication. In fact, one of my former professors and mentors is a man named Luke Timothy Johnson. And he wrote a quote, made a quote on this that I really, really like. He said this: the reason why Christians can give some kind of suffering a positive evaluation, and why even negative experiences of suffering can be transformed by the perspective of faith, is because God raises the dead to new life. In other words, resurrection is all about new creation. If you think about Jesus, he died. His body died. But then his body came out of that tomb as something new. Right? It was the same body, still had the holes in the hands and the hole in the side, but it was a new creation body. Right? It no longer suffered. It was no longer going to die. It was a glorified body, a new creation. Paul talks this way as well. In Romans 6, Paul talks about baptism. And he says baptism involves a participation in the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. Right? So, when you go down into that water, you're dying and you're being buried. When you come out of that water, you're being resurrected. And so baptism is a reenactment of that Christ event, the death, burial, and resurrection. And then Paul writes elsewhere that when you go through that, you become a new creation. Right? You're participating in the resurrection of Christ and becoming a new creation as he did. And Revelation 21, interestingly, also begins with the imagery of resurrection. Just as Christ died and his body was created anew, Paul says our bodies one day are going to die and be created anew. In Revelation 21, John seems to suggest that the same is true of creation itself. In fact, it's interesting, given the popular conceptions about Revelation, it's interesting that there is no destruction of the world recorded in the book of Revelation. There's a lot of judgment that happens on the earth and destruction that happens, but there is no destruction of the world recorded. In fact, all John says about what happens to this world, he describes it in terms of a death. Chapter 21, verse 1, he says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. And then 21:4, the first things have passed away. Notice that's all he says about the end. They passed away. Almost, again, using language like a death. The first earth, the first creation has died. And well, in Revelation, what follows after death is resurrection. So in the very next verse, 21:5, God declares, behold, I am making all things new. Where in chapter 21, creation itself is resurrected. It dies and it's reborn, recreated. There's a principle that says we know who God is by what God does. You learn about God by how God acts. And in Revelation, God creates. That's who God is. In Revelation, creation is not just something God did at the beginning of the time. It's something God is always doing. God never stops creating because he is the creator. It's part of his identity and his nature and who he is. So, for instance, in chapter 4, verse 11, John says that, you know, the 24 elders and the four living creatures declare God worthy because you created all things. Right? And he uses past tense. So it's praising God because it's looking back at his creation. But then 21:5 switches to the present tense. I am making all things new. So you have this book framed by creation, by, you know, God's first creation and God still creating in chapter 21. In fact, in line with this, I want to talk about two particular titles that are used of God in Revelation. The Alpha and the Omega. It's one of those. The second is very similar to it. He's called the beginning and the end. Now, the Alpha and the Omega, I'm sure we all know, are the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet. And it's interesting that these titles frame the book of Revelation as well. God is called the Alpha, you know, it occurs in chapter 1 and occurs again in chapter 22, right? At the beginning and the end. And this title, you know, Alpha and the Omega, is often taken to refer to the beginning point and the end point. Right? So God starts things and he ends things. That's not quite right, though. He's not saying, okay, God is the first letter and he's the last letter. What he's really saying is more like what we'd say in English, from A to Z. Not meaning he's the first and the last letters, but he's the first letter, the last letter, and every letter in between. God is all-encompassing, all creation, from the very beginning to the end, and everything in between, all of that is under God's sovereign control. And the second, and again, that's that larger perspective John's trying to get us to see, that God is doing something on the grand scale here from beginning to end. And he's trying to get his audience to fit themselves within that bigger picture. So similarly, you get this title, the beginning and the end. Which sounds, again, more like he's saying he's the beginning point and the end point. But I would suggest, again, that's not quite correct. The Greek word for beginning is arche, and it literally means something like a foundation. In other words, he's saying God laid the foundation. He laid a foundation that he's going to build on. Likewise, the word the end, the Greek word telos, means a goal. So when it says the end here, it's talking about a goal that God is building towards. You know, he's laid a foundation, and he's building on it towards a predetermined goal. We have some friends who are just finished building a new house. And if you think about that, you know, when you're building a house, you lay a foundation with a particular goal in mind. Right? You have a vision of what you want that completed house to look like. And so you start building on that foundation until you reach that goal. But once you reach that goal and the house is complete, is that the end? No. Actually, that's the beginning, because now you get to live in it. Right? You've completed your goal, and now you get to live in that house. Now things begin. Now, that's the point here. Now, God has laid a foundation that he has been building on, and when he reaches that goal, that's not the end point, that's the beginning point. Right? That's when things have become complete. And so Revelation 21 is all about that goal that God's been building towards. And he suggests there that participation in the new creation of God is the vindication and reward for faithful witness. If we fulfill that pattern of the Christ, that is our reward. What's noteworthy about this new creation, though, is the distinct absence of suffering and evil. Right, chapter 21, verse 4. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things have passed away. Right? There's no suffering in this new Jerusalem, in this new creation, because God's story is about resurrection. Right? You know, Christ's body suffered only to be resurrected as a body without suffering. Right? In the same way, creation experience, you know, just... Or to put it this way, just as Christ's new creation body was without suffering, God's new creation will be without suffering. In other words, he's setting up a parallel here. To make the point that just as the story of Christ is incomplete without resurrection, the story of creation is incomplete without resurrection. that God has a goal that he is building towards. And so Revelation suggests to us that suffering is a normal part of human experience. None of us escape it. Jesus himself did not escape it. In fact, the book of Hebrews is another particular favorite of mine. And Hebrews has an interesting take on the incarnation of Christ. In chapter 2, you know, the author of Hebrews talks about Jesus becoming human. He has this whole chapter on the incarnation. What's amazing is the reason he gives for that. And it's not the reason we usually think of. We have all these other reasons we talk about why he came here. He says simply, he became human so that he could suffer. That's the reason he gives. It's the only reason he gives. You know, that he came to suffer because if he didn't take on flesh, he couldn't suffer. So he had to become human so that he could share in our suffering. So he could experience our suffering. And so he says he came to join us in our suffering, and through that to teach us how to suffer in faith. But also because only by doing so could he give us hope. The first class period I shared the story about Ernst Caseman. I won't tell the whole story again. But about how a former professor of mine, Carl Holliday, traveled to Germany and got to meet Ernst Caseman and wanted to ask him why he was so interested in apocalyptic and one of his contemporaries, Rudolf Bultmann, wasn't. As I mentioned, Rudolf Bultmann, a sort of major figure in New Testament studies in Germany, had no interest in apocalyptic at all, tried to remove it from the Bible entirely. Whereas Ernst Caseman argued that apocalyptic was the mother of all Christian theology. For him, it was the key to everything. And so he wanted to ask Caseman, because Bultmann was dead at this point, couldn't ask him, you know, why was there such a difference between you two? And again, as I told the story, and the story's in the book too, you know, they talked about their different experiences during the rise of Hitler and World War II, and how Bultmann was spared all of that. He didn't experience any of the horrors or the evils of that. But Caseman, who preached against Nazism, was arrested and imprisoned and forced to serve in the Nazi army. And so he experienced evil firsthand. And when Carl Holliday asked him about this, he said that until one has experienced evil in its rawest forms, one cannot understand the indispensability of apocalyptic for making sense of the world. Right? When you come face to face with evil, apocalyptic is the only thing that makes sense. It's indispensable for making sense of the world. And I would suggest the reason why it's indispensable is because apocalyptic is the language of hope. Right? It's what gives us hope. You know, the good news of the gospel and the good news of Revelation are one and the same. That suffering does not survive resurrection. The message of Revelation ultimately is that in the light of resurrection, despair turns to hope. In the light of resurrection, suffering and evil do not get the last word. And that apocalyptic hope is based in the idea that the end of the story is only the beginning. And we come to the end, and that's when the story begins. And that's the story that we have to look forward to being a part of. Well, thank you for your time and attention. I do think we have like 2 minutes left. We might be able to get one or two questions in if anybody has anything.
I don't have a question, I have a comment.
Yeah. Oh, yep. Very good.
I hesitate to ask this question because it seems like answers have been given, but it seems like as you read Revelation, just keep going, that it's kind of like weed out the ones who aren't really trying hard enough. You know, it's just like, so they've been faithful so far, now they're going to go through this tribulation some more. They're going to have the mark. They're not going to be able to do this or that. You know,
well, what I argue is John is actually trying to, and this I think is another reason for symbolism, John's trying to do two things at once in this book because of the division that you have in his audience, which is you have some people, and you see this in the letters to the churches, you've got some in his churches who are being faithful witnesses. I mean, they are fulfilling that pattern of the Christ, and they're suffering because of it. You've got Antipas and Pergamum who was killed because he was a faithful witness. And so you've got some in John's churches who are experiencing the world as a place of great opposition. And John is writing to them to try to comfort them, you know, to give them endurance, to give them hope. But the other problem that, you know, many have talked about this week is the problem of accommodation. That you've got a lot of people in John's churches who have decided the best way to get along with the world is to get along with the world. You know, we're going to accommodate to Roman culture. Roman culture has a lot to offer. We can be very comfortable and prosperous in Roman culture if we just learn how to play along. And so a lot of Christians are doing that, and you see that evidence of that in the seven letters as well. And those are the people that John's writing to. As he depicts Jesus as, the warrior on the horse who's got a sword. He's coming to make war. And so he's also wanting to challenge the church, sort of to distance themselves from the world and to be more faithful in their witness. And so he's got both of those. I mean, he's trying to comfort those who are suffering, but he's also trying to challenge those who have tried to avoid suffering by accommodating to the world, to call them to be more faithful witnesses.
Yeah, you dealt with God's sovereignty early on, and I'm assuming in your book as well. You deal also with the conflict we have with the free will a man has and the sovereignty of God and suffering and how all that is intertwined. Is that in your book?
A little bit. That's part of the whole determinism section. In fact, and I think it's the second chapter, but I have a whole chapter that talks about, before getting into Revelation, issues of suffering. And so I go through, it's called theodicy, and I talk about sort of different answers that people have given today to how to explain suffering in God. There is some of that in the book, kind of laying out the different ways that people have tried to answer those questions, and then how I think Revelation is trying to answer those questions.
Yeah, because we struggle with the sovereignty of God and free will. Man.
Exactly, yes.
That's something we still struggle with.
Yes, I do address that throughout the book. Yes? I'll be around. I mean, I don't. This is my last official thing where I'm told I have to be here, so I'll be around. But I'll be in here again for the next session because my friend Ron Cox is doing the next one. So I'll be in here. I mean, if you said, I'll be in here if you want to come back, or I'll just be around. I mean, I don't have specific places I'm going to be, but yeah, just keep an eye out for me.
In Revelation 21, he seems to describe the New Jerusalem as what is paved with gold and the symbols of heaven. But seems to me that he makes that distinct and different from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to say heaven is like that, and he says this is the city that comes out of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that more of a reference to more like a perfected church or a perfected people of God?
Well, what you have there is several things, and I do try to avoid. I mean, usually I'll use the word heaven a lot to describe that just because that's what people are thinking of, and so it makes it easier to connect. But yeah, it is important. John never calls it that. It's a new heaven and a new earth. I mean, it's a whole new creation that he envisions there. But yeah, the way he describes it, he describes this New Jerusalem as a place, as a place where the people are, but he also describes it as the people themselves. I mean, it's a vision, I would argue, of God's faithful people receiving their reward. But it's John trying to describe that in symbolic language and language that they would understand and be familiar with. It's not specifically, okay, here's a literal description of what heaven's going to look like when you get here. It's saying, here's God rewarding his people, vindicating his people for their faithful witness, sort of, reaching that goal so that the story can now really begin. Well, thank you. We're out of time. We've got another group coming in here. So.